Hey everyone, and welcome to this special edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This edition of the show is brought to you with the assistance of the Hewlett Foundation, which awarded us a grant so that we could do these policy-focused podcasts for you all. And yeah, we've got a big deal guest today, the former Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. Malcolm Bly Turnbull served as a member of the Australian Parliament from 2004 until 2018 and as Prime Minister from September 2015 until August 2018. But he has been a public figure in Australia for decades. He's an Oxford-educated lawyer who studied there under a Rhodes Scholarship. He's worked as a journalist, as the personal lawyer to Australian media baron Kerry Packer. He was the leader, or a leader, of the ultimately unsuccessful campaign to make Australia a republic in the 1990s. He can also list a number of achievements in the business world. In 1994, he invested $500,000 into Australian ISP Aussie Mail, later selling his stake to WorldCom in 1999 for $57 million, which was, excellent timing on that one. He was also a managing director of Goldman Sachs in Australia, and back in the day, he even defended former MI5 agent Peter Wright when the British government attempted to have his book, Spycatcher, banned. In other words, Malcolm Turnbull is what you'd call an interesting dude. And he's also, he's loaded. Turnbull's net worth is estimated to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars range. And he's investing in technology again. He has become very, very active very quickly. And a lot of startups I speak to here in Australia, cybersecurity startups, they have spoken to him or his people. His first security investment here is in Casada, an Australian bot traffic mitigation company. And a disclaimer here, Casada has sponsored a couple of editions of Risky Biz in the past, but they are not currently a client or a sponsor of the podcast. But it's just better to point that out for clarity. And yeah, he's Casada's chairman now, and I'm sure he'll be making other investments here as time goes on. And it makes sense to us observers that he's making these moves because Malcolm Turnbull actually gives a shit about cybersecurity. His time as Prime Minister saw the government actually pay attention to cybersecurity issues. Whether that was excluding Huawei from our 5G build, before it was cool, launching the 2016 cybersecurity strategy with actual fanfare, appointing a minister for cybersecurity, or having a cybersecurity advisor working out of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Malcolm had you covered. He also launched a bunch of initiatives to stimulate the local cybersecurity industry, and some of those initiatives led to Australian startups appearing in Snake Oilers segments on this program. Now, despite him saying he's not much of a technical guy, you will hear that Turnbull actually has a grip on key security issues. So in this interview, you're going to hear him talk about Huawei and the NBN and 5G builds, the controversial assistance and access bill or TOLA bill. He speaks about metadata retention, political accountability in the cybers and more. Now, one thing I'm doing a little bit differently in this podcast is adding annotations, right? So when you hear this noise, that means an annotation is starting, just a note, right? And when you hear this noise, that's the end of the note. And I decided to add these annotations because most Risky Business listeners are actually located outside of Australia. And if I didn't include them, those listeners might miss a few things, like a little bit of context. Anyway, here is the interview. I started off by asking Malcolm Turnbull why he's so interested in cybersecurity, and here's what he had to say.
Well, it's clearly the challenge is obviously very real. So I guess the question is, why was I personally interested in it? Well, I've always had a big interest in networks, computing. I'm not a coder. I don't claim to have any technical skills, but I ask a lot of questions and try to understand things pretty well. And I've got a conceptual understanding of the challenges that we're facing. And I took the view that we needed to become much, much more alert to the cybersecurity challenge. I wanted to get a cybersecurity industry going in Australia. And that was so there was a whole innovation agenda there behind the cybersecurity strategy of 2016. But I also wanted to reach out and make sure that the public understood the issue and that business understood the issue, because, you know, it's the point that Rob Joyce made to you in your podcast with him. You know, the days when signals intelligence organizations could regard their job as being limited only to government is really over. I mean, everybody is so connected. The attack vectors are ubiquitous, right? So you've got to make sure that everybody is maintaining a high level of cybersecurity awareness. And my concern was, and I think Snowden was a very good example of this, you know, a lot of senior leadership, even in an organization like the NSA, were clearly not sufficiently aware of who had, you know, systems administrator level access, where data was actually stored, you know, where it was mirrored, you know, probably more relevantly. So, you know, we just needed to get a lot more high level of awareness. You know, there's a lot of, you know, and they would still be there today. But, you know, I remember 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, you know, just reflecting on how many large industrial businesses, some in the tech, you know, telecom tech area, others, you know, grittier industrial businesses, you know, would have a lot of machines that were connected one way or another to the internet, where the user ID was admin and the password was 1234 or 000.
Well, I think sadly we are still somewhat in the same place. Like, things are improving, but it's a shocker. And you're right, people weren't necessarily aware that things were quite as bad as they were.
No, and so I think that, you know, so that's why I wanted to take it on. And I'd learned a lot about network security from people in the ASD over the years, and also from Mike Galvin, you know, who I think I mentioned in my book, in the chapter on the NBN. Mike was the guy that had been in charge of BT security, but had been at that time, this is like 2013, was in charge of the rollout of their broadband, you know, their fixed line broadband network, which they were doing, you know, as we ended up doing as a multi-technology program. They didn't use HFC, as far as I'm aware, but they were certainly doing a lot of fiber to the node. And so I spent a lot of time with Mike understanding the characteristics of that type of network and the various risks and the way you can mitigate.
I'm very glad you brought that up, because you describe in your book that that Mike had you convinced that it was a low-risk strategy to use high-risk vendors at the edge of the NBN. Now, of course, you were in opposition, not in government at this point, and the then Labor government had announced that it would ban Huawei from participating in the NBN rollout, and that was a decision at the time that you disagreed with.
Yeah, well, I was satisfied that you could mitigate the risk if the Huawei participation, or the high risk vendor participation — Huawei is not the only high risk vendor, and China is not the only provider of high risk.
Well, I've heard you mention Israel as another potentially high risk country in a different interview. Yeah,
it has been. Yeah, and so if you limit that, their kit to the edge, and the edge being in the context of a FTTN network, really the multi-service access nodes that are, you know, on the streets, you know, that are connecting to the last mile, or more likely last couple of hundred meters of copper wire. The conclusion that BT had was that they could manage that, right? And look, it's not without risk, you know, I mean, but it's just a question of trading it off against the obvious savings, you know, because if the more vendors you get into the mix, the better price you'll get. It may be that you ended up buying mostly European or American boxes, but if there was some competition, you'd probably get them at a better price. So that core edge distinction was really central to everything that was being done in terms of network security. I mean, there was a sort of famous chart, I suppose, or you know, slide that, you know, you would get, that I'm sure everyone has seen over the years. you know, the so-called, you know, onion rings, you know, and people would sagely say, well, you know, in the center is the core, and, you know, and then they work out through different layers of the network and you end up right at the edge with, you know, a handset, you know, and you say, okay, well, you know, we can live with high-risk vendors at the edge, but as you get closer to the core, you know, element manager and functions like that, that's where you want to have more highly trusted equipment.
And I see where you're going with this, which is that, you know, that distinction between the core and the edge kind of breaks down a little bit in the 5G context, which is why...
Well, it does. And look, to be honest, I was the government, you know, when we got re-elected in 2013, the government took the view, this was, you know, Abbott's government took the view to just maintain the, to not change the procurement policy. And I think that was fair enough. It was probably a bit late in the day to make a change, but...
But surely, given what we know now about Huawei, perhaps excluding them from, you know, controlling the edge of a national broadband network might have actually been a sensible decision?
Well, you wouldn't know. They wouldn't be controlling it. I mean, what they did in the UK... Now, look, again, you know, I was relying on the UK experience, right? So I'm very... In these type of things, I'm totally fact-based. So if the experience is has differed, then you'd take a different decision. But... What they did was they used, I think, for the MSANs, at least three vendors. They had a Chinese vendor, they had an Israeli vendor, they used Alcatel, as NBN did. They may have used some kit from Adtran, is that right? American provider. So that they mixed it up and they were judicious about where they put MSANs and, you know, which one they mixed it up. And look, it was designed to save them money. I mean, you know, they figured they saved a couple of hundred million quid in
which is a meaningful amount of money, right?
That's right. And you see, I mean, the thing about telecom networks, as you know, is that they've got, in a modern telecom network, the operating costs are low relative to the capital cost. You're essentially a zero marginal cost provider of services. In the other words, the classic example is a subsea cable. You know, you put a fiber optic cable from here to Japan and, you know, you light it up. Whether it's, you know, a tenth full or 50% full is very material to your revenues. It is your revenues, may well be your revenues. But your cost is there. You know, you have literally sunk cost.
Quite literally.
Well, this is the same phenomenon with renewables, by the way. So you get enough, you know, there are businesses where people will look at, in the electricity world, they talk about the long-term cost of electricity as a means of comparing different forms of generation. That's important, particularly for a banker or an investor. But in terms of the way the market operates, if you're a gas generator and gas is expensive, your marginal cost of generating a megawatt hour of power may be $50 or $60 or $70 or whatever. It could be a lot higher, depending on the price of gas. If I'm a wind farm, my LCOE might be comparable because of a high capital cost, but my marginal cost is zero. And there are similar issues with telecom infrastructure. Anyway, we're sort of drifting a little.
That's all right.
We're drifting a little. All right.
But look, cool. I mean, the Huawei thing certainly escalated to quite a degree while you were, you know, communications minister and then later prime minister. If we look back, I mean, the first really serious, credible reports about something being amiss with Huawei, I remember a 2009 report from Cameron Stewart in the Australian newspaper saying that ASIO had essentially launched a counterintelligence investigation against Huawei in Australia. So this is something that had been brewing for a long time, but it did come to a head during your time in government. Is that an accurate assessment that it did really escalate in terms of the intelligence available to you and the sort of policy environment did really change, or was this just a case of the government changing its decision-making process?
No, it's a changed circumstances. Look, that there had been a general view that you could live with high-risk vendor kit on the edge in most network environments, right? And from a vendor's point of view, from say Huawei's point of view, that wasn't a bad outcome because there's obviously a lot more gear on the edge than there is in the core of the network, if you think about it, you know. So there's, you know, it's still a very lucrative opportunity. Now, what happened was that as 5G comes along, and 5G is quite different. 5G, as we know, stands for fifth generation, and it covers a whole lot of technologies and protocols and techniques and trends that have been going on for some time. But one of the most important trends is virtualization. So more and more of the things that the functions in a network that had been done with bespoke hardware were being done by software, just, you know, running on
wherever.
Wherever. And in order to reduce the latency, and that's really its big promise, that reduction in latency, you need to have your processing right at the edge, right, distributed through the network. So instead of a signal going from, you know, the radio access network at the edge into the center, into the core, and then back out again, it's a different, it's, it is a
You've
different...
got much more flexible routing and whatnot. No, I mean, I think, you know, most of the audience would be sort of aware of that. It's interesting, though, because you sound very much like Mike Burgess when you're talking about this. Mike Burgess was head of the Australian Signals Directorate and is now the head of Australia's domestic spy agency, ASIO. And I'm guessing...
Well, that's probably because he's Mike Burgess has been one of my educators over the years.
Yeah.
But when we made the decision to ban high-risk vendors, including Huawei, from the 5G, that had been a long time coming. I mean, that work was going on for... a year. Well, I was involved in work on that topic for well over a year. And what I was doing was seeking to encourage, you know, my goal ideally was to see if we could find a way to allow all vendors to participate and satisfactorily mitigate the risk. Because in an ideal world, because then you would get. Yeah, I say describe all this in the book.
It's all there in the book, which is that, you know, that was what you were pushing for. There seems to be this view that you came in and you're like, no Huawei, but your book describes that you really wanted them to be able to participate. Yeah. And it was basically just the experts coming in and saying, you really don't want to do this.
But we didn't did more than that. I mean, I interrogated them and we went through, you know, I remember huge reports, you know, with all the different measures that could be deployed, their cost, their effectiveness, and all of that. You know, we looked at it really, really carefully. And the conclusion was that we couldn't satisfactorily mitigate the risk. And so that's why the decision was taken. So it was not a political decision. Obviously, there were political consequences and implications, but it was made in a very thoughtful and considered way. And Mike Burgess and his team, because I appointed Mike, director of ASD, as you know, and made it an executive agency, et cetera. Mike spent a lot of time and his people spent a lot of time consulting with Five Eyes partners and other friendly countries, signals intelligence people, people in industry. I mean, they really did give a very, very careful examination of it. So the important points to take out of that is, one, it was not just a political decision. Two, we looked at the options very, very carefully and with great encouragement from me to see if we could find a way around it. And we did not do it on instructions from Washington. You know, quite in fact, the 5G issue was one that I raised with the Americans, good 18 months or so before, not long after Trump was elected, actually.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because another big event that happened in, the cybersecurity world when you were prime minister was, of course, the DNC hack. We first heard of this thanks to CrowdStrike's report, which came out, you know, around the middle of that year. Was this something that was occupying a lot of your thought when this happened, or did that sort of kick in later after the US election?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, we were alert to it as it was reported, and we I arranged for Alistair McGibbon to talk to the political parties in Australia, you know, talk to the federal directors and party leaders, just to make sure that they were alert to this and were taking some basic precautions. Yeah, no, we were very, very, very alert to it, and obviously keeping an eye out for any evidence of that in Australia, which, you know, we didn't see much evidence of that in 2016. I mean, there was a sort of a cyber, or, you know, a cyber abuse, I guess you could call it that, in that election, which was that, you know, Mediscare that Labor ran.
Mediscare. Now, this was an underhanded political trick pulled by Australia's centre-left party, the Labor Party, before the 2016 election. Sometime before the election, Turnbull's Liberal Party had proposed privatising the Medicare payments network, or at least they discussed it. Not Medicare itself, but the network that handles essentially the point-of-sale tech that you swipe your Medicare card into when you go to the doctors. I mean, it's crazy, but that network was and still is operated by the government. And there was some talk of putting that out to tender, which, to be honest, strikes me as a pretty sensible idea. But it gave Labor, the Labor Party, a chance to run a scare campaign that the Conservative Liberal Party planned to privatise Medicare, which is obviously something that does not go down well here, right? So the Liberals ditched the plan, but Labor kept up the attack, and the whole thing culminated in the Labor Party, just before the election, conducting a mass SMS campaign claiming that the Liberals would privatise Medicare. But they made the message appear to come from Medicare itself, in the sender field. So, you know, at best it was sleazy and dishonest politics. At worst, I mean, you know, there was even an argument about the legality of the Mediscare campaign. So that is Mediscare. Well, I don't know if we'd tie that to the issue of cybersecurity. I mean, there might have been some sort of dodgy info there.
But I'm just saying, well, it was an abuse in the sense that they were sending text messages to people, you know, who were older and poorer in marginal seats, saying, purporting to come from Medicare, you know, saying, you know, the Liberals are going to sell Medicare. So a lot of people actually thought that they were getting that message from Medicare itself, which is the impression they sought to create. And should have been, you know, you can't do that now.
Hey, that was low rent. Yeah. That was definitely low rent.
Low rent was pretty damn effective.
But look, I mean, you know, when we reflect back on this operation, this hack and leak against the United States, against its, you know, democratic processes, I would think that as the leader of a country, you would look at that and it would make you run a little bit cold, just looking at the implications of that.
Yeah, well, it's terrifying, right? Because you've gone from a world where all of your media was curated to a world in which many people, most people, are getting getting a lot of their information out of uncurated social media, you know, Twitter and Facebook in particular. The ability to manipulate that is enormous. You may recall a few months ago there were these right-wing demonstrations in state capitals, parliaments in the United States, protesting against the lockdown, you know, and running this whole sort of line, you know, this is COVID's a hoax and, you know, we shouldn't shut down our economy and blah, blah, blah. And that appeared to have a lot of support online. I can't remember the group that identified it, but they said that they'd concluded that 60% of the tweets supporting these demonstrations were from bots on Twitter.
Well, I mean, that's the one issue, isn't it? When you've got these bot armies that are elevating things into becoming trending topics and whatnot. I think the thing that I found particularly chilling about 2016 is you had, you know, an actual computer intrusion and then the selective and timed drip, drip, drip leaking of things to sort of manipulate the news cycle. And, you know, the media to a degree was sort of playing the game as well. So it sort of derailed what would have been a fairly extraordinary election campaign in the United States, but it certainly shifted the agenda in a meaningful way. And that's the thing that I found quite spooky.
Totally. Well, I mean, you know, the reality is from Russia's point, you know, what is Russia trying to achieve here? what Russia wants to do is destabilize the West. You know, it's essentially a spoiling game. So you had a lot of Russian support for right-wing populist parties in Europe. A lot of Russian money went into the Brexit campaign. Now, you know, I mean, you've got to hand it to them. I mean, they've been pretty successful. I mean, if you say, you know, the combination of right-wing populism, you know, particularly in the media from people like Murdoch, Russian money, and all of that, that all merging together, that creates, that gets the momentum to get Brexit over the line. And that has weakened Europe, weakened the European Union, and it certainly weakened Britain. Now, if you think about it, if you think about Western democracy and, you know, the Western security, right, obviously the United States is overwhelmingly the biggest player. But then when you get into the second rank, the UK is there. It has the most capable, you know, military assets in Europe. It is a nuclear power. It's a permanent member of the Security Council. I mean, it's not the Britain of, you know, 150 years ago, but it's still a very potent force. But
I would be tempted to say thank heavens for that.
But just think about it.
Yeah.
It has, by virtue of Brexit, at a time of rising protectionism, chosen to leave the largest free trade zone in the world. How can that be good news for Britain economically?
Well, and you see the hand of sort of information operations and hack and leak and these sorts of things. You see the hand of that hand in this, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's quite clear. I mean, I think this is all well understood and documented. Now, obviously, foreign government information operations cannot, it's hard for them to conjure an issue out of nothing, but they can provide important support at critical times.
But that's when you're getting to the points of disagreement. That's when it becomes a chicken and egg sort of conversation. You know, are the bots resonating because the conditions were already there, or are the conditions being created by the bots? And it's going to be, there's a few PhDs in that, I suspect.
Yeah, you know, if you've got lots of humans who want to get on and tweet in support of some crazy agenda, I guess they're free to do so. But if you use bots to create the impression that there are millions of people tweeting about something when it's in fact just one or two people, you know, who are good programmers, that's wrong. Because essentially that's misleading, isn't it?
I think, look, you know, most of the audience for this podcast is actually based in the United States, and I think they'd be quite surprised to learn that you are actually of Australia's Conservative Party. You are of Australia's Conservative movement, because the way you speak about these issues to them makes you sound like you're from the centre-left. I mean, politics has really changed.
I think if I was in American politics, I would be on the, you know, the Democrat side of the political divide. I mean, there are no longer many smaller liberals left in the Republican Party. I suspect there aren't any. I mean, you know, what do they used to call them? The Rockefeller Republicans, you know, after Nelson Rockefeller, sort of small L liberal progressive people. I mean, in the age of Trump, you've only got to look at the Republican National Convention, right? I mean, it looked like it's essentially become sort of a one-man party, hasn't it? Or one family party. I mean, you had the royal Trump family were there. They seemed to provide half the speakers.
Well, I think I have to give props to Sam Clench of news.com.au. Funnily enough, a Murdoch-owned outlet who transcribed Kimberly Guilfoyle's speech in all caps, which was got a decent chuckle out of that.
But you see, this is the problem, that we've now got the situation where people can basically select their own news, you can always select your own opinion, but people are selecting their own facts.
Yeah.
And what populist approaches have worked out is that you can get away with extraordinary lies. I mean, the Mediscare example, which I sort of unpack in my book, is very, very terribly interesting, because when Labor first said, you know, Rand said, oh, the Liberals are going to sell Medicare, everyone rolled around laughing. I mean, journalists mocked them. It was just, and there was a lot of skepticism on the Labor side to say, well, this is just such a stupid thing to say. You know, I mean, like, it's bonkers. It's not true. It's not possible. Anyway, I mean, you know, Shorten obviously thought this was cutting through, but it cut through with particular demographic, with the, you know, what they call them, low information voters, by which you basically mean people who are older, tend to be older, less educated, sicker, more anxious about health because they're older and have worse health than younger people, and they don't have, you know, they're struggling financially.
I think it's interesting that you've
targeted that message at that particular group, and no matter how ludicrous it is to most people, it can be deadly, very effective in a deadly way.
I think it's interesting that you've come back to that twice, right? Because this is a conversation about sort of foreign intelligence services and targeted information operations. And I think you seem to be arguing that there's been a bit of a convergence in the approach from political parties.
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is this is the point. The techniques that foreign information services, if that's the right term, use are techniques that are used by people within your own jurisdiction. I would have no doubt that most of the malicious activity going on in, you know, with fake accounts on Facebook and bogus tweets and wild claims and all conspiracy theories, I would have no doubt that the bulk of that in the United States today is coming from within the good old US of A, you know, by people who are Americans.
It becomes a self-sourcing pudding, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, what the DNC operation was, I mean, what was different there? So I think in terms of social media, a lot of people are at it, right? In terms of the DNC thing, that was a break-in, right? That was a digital version of a break-in, and found some interesting, you know, embarrassing emails, and then leaked them out at the time that was most damaging to the Democrats.
Actually, you're the perfect person to ask about this because you're known for having, opinions on climate change that don't necessarily mesh with those of the populist right. But one hack that had an absolutely massive impact, one hack and leak operation, was the hack and leak of emails belonging to the climate research unit of the East Anglia University right before the Copenhagen summit. Of course, Labor was in government at that time, but when we look back on that, at the time we thought maybe some state had a hand in this. In retrospect, that looks almost certainly like a lock. Do you remember having any feelings about that one at the time?
Well, it was, I was appalled by it. And of course, this is always a risk. This is why people have got to be very careful what they put in writing, you know, in a digital anywhere. Because, you know, what one of the problems with a lot of the sort of informal communication we have, whether it's by email or text messages or whatever, is that it can be very readily taken out of context, you know.
Well, this gives me an amazing opportunity to segue now, because during your time in government, you copped a bit of flack for using end-to-end based, encrypted messaging platforms, while at the same time, you know, arguing that technology firms needed to do more to enable law enforcement access. At the time, your comments were interpreted as being a direct attack on end-to-end encryption. I'm not necessarily sure that those criticisms hit the mark necessarily. So why don't I start by asking that question? What are your feelings on end-to-end encryption? Do you feel like this is something that should be banned or outlawed?
Oh, well, it certainly shouldn't be banned. The only, you know, I mean, I think actually it's of enormous importance. I mean, I think encryption is good. The question is, what do we do about legitimate law enforcement who who wants to have access to it, right? And, you know, courts have been giving search warrants, you know, for hundreds and thousands of years, possibly, one way or another. And you've got companies that have created end-to-end encryption that they claim they cannot decrypt. Literally, it is encrypted.
Well, I mean, they can't. They don't currently possess the means to do that, right?
That wasn't the right word. So it is undecryptable by them.
Yes, they've locked themselves out of the part where they can actually intercept these messages. Yes.
Now, in an ideal world, law enforcement would be able to get access to that. in the same way I can get access to, you know, the secret files held in your safe, you know, with a court order. The problem is, and this is, you know, this is, I think this is the problem. The problem is that if you create a backdoor that enables the, you know, system operator to decrypt your messages with a court order, okay, that's fine. But what happens if somebody else can work out how to use that key? You know, if you create a vulnerability, that means that vulnerability can be used by somebody else.
So you're actually sounding more like one of the critics of the AA bill, which I felt was a sort of misunderstood bit of legislation. The Assistance and Access Bill, the AA Bill, the Telecommunications and Other Legislation Act, or TOLA, whatever you want to call it. This was very controversial. This was reported as Australia's full frontal assault on end-to-end encryption. Look, you could twist your interpretation of the Act, which wasn't particularly well-written legislation, but you could twist your interpretation to say that it could do things like outlaw end-to-end, but look, that's a really bad faith reading. In fact, after this bill was passed, a journalist from The Guardian FOI'd the law enforcement guide to how to use this legislation to get tech companies to provide assistance, and it really doesn't look like to me that this legislation was being used to outlaw end-to-end encryption. It really was about introducing a framework that would allow tech companies to cooperate with law enforcement and giving the government a lever to pull if they wanted tech to do something that they didn't want to do. So that is the AA bill, or TOLA. And yeah, that's the end of this note.
I think it's I think that is the core problem. So what's the way around that? Well, the way around that is that what security services can do is, with the appropriate, you know, authorities, warrants, etc., they can get a bit of code onto a device, which is essentially a keylogger that can read your messages in, you know, when they're in clear, as you, you know, they're sitting on your phone. So that's how you get to somebody's WhatsApp, but or Signal or whatever. But
that's expensive. That's very expensive, and it's getting more expensive all the time.
It is getting more expensive all the time. There are quite a few complexities about it, but it's also tactical, because you see what, before encryption, the signals intelligence people went through a happy period where they could intercept everything and read everything, right? And with more powerful processors, they could sift and, you know, analyze and filter everything to their heart's degree. Now they can intercept everything and read nothing, or read very little. So they've got to be much more tactical. So it is, look, it's that these are very complex issues. But you see, the difficulty is, so the fundamental problem is, in an ideal world, yes, there would be a key that would enable legitimate law enforcement to have the ability to intercept, as they have been doing with telecoms, you know, forever. However, the problem is that would then be, that then becomes inevitably a weakness that will be available to others. And also there's an element of pointlessness in it, or futility in it, is probably a better word, because if we were to say, let's say, Facebook were required to have that for WhatsApp. Okay. For the vast majority of WhatsApp's customers couldn't care less, right? But the people who you're actually after will then move to another.
They'll move to Signal.
They might move to Telegram, which of course belongs to two Russian brothers and is hosted, last time I checked, in Berlin. But I mean, or there'll be one that'll be hosted in, you know, in Russia or somewhere else.
Of course. But the public response to the AA bill was, you know, the interpretation by a lot of people was that the bill was designed to introduce the sort of weakness that shouldn't be introduced.
Well, it isn't. And I mean, the bill, I mean, the you know, I was very involved with that. I mean, I didn't, it was, you know, finally passed after I ceased to be PM, but I was very involved in the discussions and some of the redrafting of it, and I certainly made it very clear at the time that we could not get into a situation where we were forcing people to decrypt things that would, in other words, that would introduce weaknesses or flaws. But what we wanted to get was assistance for what we meaning, you know, the AFP and ASIO and so forth, to get assistance where it would not compromise the security of the, you know, of the, you know,
why is there such a disconnect between the public's perception of that bill and the intent of the bill? Because I covered all of this at the time, and I closer to your view on this, right? Which is that it was attempting at least to be balanced. Not perfect, and there are some issues with the bill that I've been on record saying should change. But where does this disconnect come from? There was the infamous line that you used where, and I know it was off the cuff, and I thought it was actually quite dumb for opponents of the bill to make the issue, you know, to peg their arguments against an off the cuff line. But you said, you know, the laws of mathematics are all very well and good, but you know, the laws of Australia trump all, or words to that effect.
I can't remember. Misunderstood or misrepresented. The laws of mathematics are very commendable, but the only law that applies in Australia is the law of Australia. But look, I think part of the problem is that probably since I left, there isn't at a senior level anyone taking an interest in cybersecurity. I mean, that's the truth. You know, there isn't a minister for cybersecurity. I don't think Scott Morrison is particularly interested in it or, you know, familiar with it. And so you need to have senior ministers that are spending a lot of time thinking and learning about this.
You're saying that, you know, they didn't have anyone who could sell it right.
But it's more than just sell it. It's that what you've got to do is it's got to be a very interactive process, because you remember when I established the National Innovation and Science Agenda in 2015, someone said to me, do you guarantee all these, you know, measures will work? There are about two dozen of them. And I said, no. I said, some of them will not work. And those that don't work, we'll dump. Those that we can improve, we'll improve. And those that do well, we'll do more of. And if someone else is solving the problem more effectively than us, we'll shamelessly plagiarise them, right? So, you know, what you need to be doing in an area like this is constantly, you've got to be sitting down with the people in the industry and saying, okay, is this working? How is this working? You know, trying to solve this problem in a way that's not effective. I mean, I there's a discussion in my book, a story about, you remember that period when Abbott was prime minister, where, you know, they wanted to have the metadata retention.
It's funny that you bring that up, because at the time you were communications minister and the AG was doing an absolutely terrible job of explaining the policy. At one point, a friend of mine who's a communications journalist was staying at my house in Byron Bay. You were due to do an appearance somewhere in Brisbane. So he drove up, managed to jump out behind a ficus with a microphone and record an interview with you. And he published that as a Q&A on itnews.com.au, in which you gave actually a really good explanation of the Metadata Retention Act at that time. So I remember it well.
The problem was that when, you know, Abbott and then George went out with it,
Tony Abbott was the Conservative Prime Minister here before Turnbull. George is George Brandis, the then Attorney General, whose absolutely appalling attempt at defining metadata during a Sky News interview with David Spears was both hilarious and troubling.
They didn't know. It's a classic case of the way Abbott ran the government. You know, it was all just chasing one tabloid headline after another. And so they didn't know whether they were talking about the user's IP, you know, the IP address of my device that I'm using, or the IP address of the computer I'm connecting to, you know, the, you know, whatever. You know,
I've never seen a policy so poorly communicated at that time.
I had a huge row. We had rows in the cabinet. I roused with Abbott about it. It was just a train wreck. And I actually helped him out there, you know. So I got a meeting in my office in Sydney at Edgecliff, with George, ASIO was there, AFP was there, ASD was there, AG department was there, you know, like got, would have been 20 people around the table. And I've just said, look, I said, you have got to, we've got to have some precision here about what we're talking about. This is madness running out here, you know, talking about metadata and you don't know what you're talking about. And actually the official who was the only person, frankly, on the official side who I thought really understood what we were talking, we needed to talk about, was Andrew Colvin. And, you know, and Andrew just basically said, what we need, what we're looking for is the user's IP address, which, of course, for most devices is, or very often, if they're connected to a telecom network, is dynamically allocated.
Yeah, so, no, I mean, that was, it's clear, like most, the bulk of the use, people didn't understand, people who are opposing that didn't quite understand this. And look, you know, say what you want about whether there should have been more protections or whatnot. The idea that AFP and, you know, even state and territory police would lose all metadata because businesses couldn't be bothered storing it anymore, that was not going to be a good outcome for the community.
No, no, well, no, it wasn't. But equally, you don't want to have the police, you know, people, the carriers, telcos, being required
to capture everything. Yeah.
To capture the IP addresses of everybody you connect to and keep that log forever. I mean that, you know, because then essentially Big Brother would be looking at everything you did over everybody did over the internet all the time, which I don't, you know, was again, I mean, there are some people in the intelligence world who like that idea, but you know, they would like to have, you know, a camera in every room and every house.
Camera in every home. Oh, yeah, God, yeah. Please, no. So, look, we've touched on something interesting here, which is I feel like, you know, you're sort of describing a couple of different scenarios in which the government's inability at a political level to communicate the rationale behind a policy has caused, you know, has caused pushback, has caused problems, which is why I feel like a lot of politicians will leave it to senior bureaucrats to comment on this stuff. And the senior bureaucrats will just say no comment because they don't want to get involved in discussing a,
Well, you know. Well, this is where Alistair McGibbon was very helpful.
Yes. Alistair McGibbon was the inaugural director of the Australian Federal Police's high-tech crime centre in the early 2000s. After years with the AFP, he went on to work at eBay as its Australian trust and safety head. It did a few things, wound up back in government, but now is the chief strategy officer for CyberCX. But yes, he did work for Malcolm Turnbull as his sort of right-hand man in his department, in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, sort of working on cyber issues.
Al Mack was a senior official, a very important public servant, but he was also prepared to be very discursive, you know, great communicator. And so he was not only a good source of advice to me, but he was a fantastic communicator. And, you know, that's the sort of role of the Australian Cybersecurity Centre.
And when you were PM, you actually had a junior minister. It was one of their other responsibilities was
Dan Tehan.
Dan Tehan, yeah. He was also the Minister for Cybersecurity, right? But, you know, when we think about who was really out there effectively communicating during your time, it was McGibbon, who is not an elected official. I mean, do you think that this is, you know, so you've got your political accountability for matters on cybersecurity, which is, you know, which is a, you know, a minister. And then you've got someone else who's more of a right hand of you who's out there doing the comms.
I'd say this. I mean, anyone with, you know, some technical knowledge could expose the limits of my you know, so-called tech savviness in a heartbeat. Right?
Well, you describe that in your book. You say that you have an outsized reputation for tech savviness.
And I have disclaimed it always. But I can talk or bluff my way through it generally. But most politicians don't have any background in it or interest in it. So I think you do need a minister who is clearly responsible for cybersecurity. It should be someone who is prepared to actually learn. They've got to be someone who's not a once-over lightly skimmer of things, which a lot of people in politics are. So you want to have someone who's a little bit nerdy.
You just described Tim Watts, by the way.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Okay, well, that's good.
I was being a bit cheeky here. Tim Watts is currently the Shadow Minister for Cybersecurity and Telecommunications, so he's from the other side of politics to Turnbull. We'll get Tim on the show eventually because he has some interesting stuff to say.
And, but then I do think it's a good idea to have somebody in the ALMAC role who can be a consistent public spokesman, you know, slash chief educator on these issues. I mean, the Alistair MacGibbon came into my orbit when we set up the Children's eSafety Commissioner function, which then became the eSafety Commissioner, and that's now Julie Inman Grant, you know, who is, again, very technically literate, like Alistair, but a great communicator. And that's a very important role. So I think I just don't think you can have too many knowledgeable people talking about this issue, because it's got to become front of mind, you know, because otherwise, you know, you might have fantastic security in government, and that's obviously not the case, but you'll end up with huge weaknesses in the rest of your system, you know.
So you think the combination between having someone who is politically accountable and also having a senior public servant who could act as a bit of a connector, educator, spokesperson, that worked well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it worked very well. Because, yeah.
I'd have to say my experience as working as a journalist, you know, through your prime ministership, the fact that, okay, when census fail happened, I was actually the first journalist to publish what had actually gone wrong there. I had some good sourcing on that. Census fail. Basically, this refers to the failure of online systems associated with the 2016 census in Australia. The idea was mostly it would be done online, and on census night, it didn't go so well. IBM and the Bureau of Statistics really messed it up. They didn't have adequate DDoS prevention, and then when a little DDoS attack came along, the brown stuff really hit the fan. Their monitoring wasn't so good. They thought the site had been popped, so they pulled the pin. There were problems with failover kit not being configured. The whole thing was an absolute mess. But I think within a few hours of me first publishing, I was able to get ALMAC on the phone to essentially confirm what I had and give me a... I mean, there was some real transparency there that I'm not really accustomed to. And he and I would speak when he was in that job. And it was great. It was very unusual to have that degree of access as a journalist to someone who could really effectively communicate. This turned into the ALMAC show. This is amazing.
But I mean, we do have a massive vested interest in everybody else's cybersecurity. Mm. So I might have the greatest, you know, defenses, and my staff might be really shrewd and cautious and clever in the way they handle their internet connected devices and so forth. But if the law firm that's doing confidential work for me, you know, or the accounting firm or the other person I'm contracting with has got, you know, lesser standards, then, you know, like everything can be thwarted, right? So we do need to have a increase in the level of awareness across the board. And that's, you know, that's why you've got the ACSC, and that's why you need to be talking about it.
Now, so, look, we're gonna sort of start wrapping it up here, right? Because you've been very generous. You've been very generous with your time, and I understand it's finite. But it seems like, you know, technology investing is something you're known for. You were an investor in Aussie Mail, which was Australia's first sort of decent retail ISP. Sold that for a bunch of money, you know, fantastic. You've come full circle. You're back to technology investing now with a particular emphasis on cybersecurity. I mean, essentially, you are now a full-time cybersecurity investor. Is that an accurate description? Because every single startup I talk to, they're talking to you.
The main cybersecurity investment we've got, there's a couple that are not yet public, but the main one we've got is Casada. We talked about that earlier. But I would say I'm spending, you know, most of my time now on venture capital investing, and cyber is a very key part of that. So I spend a lot of time looking at cybersecurity companies. I think it's an area of enormous importance. I find it very exciting, and I love working with new disruptive businesses, but I'm not limited to cybersecurity.
Okay. I think one thing that's interesting that you've said is that you see cybersecurity as an issue generally, and this is an interesting thing to talk about, given your time in government, where it's mostly about the threat, you know, and now you're an investor, it's mostly about the opportunity. But on balance, you say you see more cybersecurity as more of an opportunity than a threat.
Well, it's both. I mean, I think there's a gigantic opportunity. I mean, the threat brings the opportunity, and, you know, I'm not sure whether the reverse is true. No, but it is. And I mean, and you know, there's a lot of different dimensions to it. I mean, there's a lot more to cyber, you know. Okay, an area that is of increasing interest to me is industrial control systems, you know, or operating technology. The cyber security implications for those businesses is quite different to, you know, a government department, for example, you know, where it's basically information security you're concerned about. If you're a big power station, your adversary's goal typically will be to get into your system, understand every single element about it, just sit there, learn everything about it, and be in a position at a time and manner of their choosing to, you know, blow something up or turn something off or, you know, whatever, create some mayhem.
Did you have some of those briefings as PM that really scared the willies out of you?
I'm not easily scared, but no, I've certainly discussed it. I mean, I have to give a shout out to Stephen Smith when he was the defence minister under Labor. When I was shadow communications minister, I asked Stephen if I could get regular briefings at DSD, as it then was. And Stephen, to his credit, he said, yeah, that's fine. And he got onto the Defence Signals Directorate and he said, look, just, you know, Malcolm's very interested in this area. Just talk to him as though you'd talk to me, you know. And I had, you know, I was a regular with DSD before I was a minister, and then I continued.
So you'd already had time to become desensitized to some of the spookier briefings.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't, you know, it's a lot of these issues, even for a non-technical person like me, you just have to reflect on them, you know, think about them, and at a conceptual level, you can see where the risks and vulnerabilities are, and then the question is, you know, what are you doing about it? And you know, it's I think in a world of an Internet of Things, you know, with billions of sensors all talking to each other, these risks to, you know, what I could call operating technologies is going to be so much greater, you know, because you may have it's a bit like having a back door that, you know, nobody knows about except your adversary, you know, who may have discovered it and is just waiting to use it at a time of their choosing, you know, which is why, you know, penetration testing is so important. Anyway,
I'm going to have to wrap it up.
I've rambled on. Sorry, so, I apologize.
That's fine. Malcolm Turnbull, thank you so much for joining us on our humble little, cybersecurity podcast. It's been a fascinating discussion for me to talk to someone who is a leader of a country about an issue that, you know, certainly I'm interested in. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Patrick. See you soon.
That was former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull there with a chat about all things cyber. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to all the people who told him doing this interview was a good idea. And that is it from me today. I do hope you've enjoyed this special edition of the show, but until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.